Parashat Be'alotcha. We begin with the mitzvah of lighting the menorah. Rambam holds that the menorah was lit twice, every evening and every morning. The generally accepted opinion is that the wicks were prepared in the morning, but it was only lit in the evening. We have two opinions about how the menorah was set up, whether the menorah was set up east to west or north to south. Right? So, if you have the Holy of Holies here, right? The Holy of Holies was most westward. The easy way to remember it is what Rambam writes, that all the nations would always bow to the east. They always made the holiest side on the east, facing the sunrise. The Torah says the exact opposite. Make the holiest on the west. Turn your backs to the east, to the sunrise. The holiest is on the west. The Holy of Holies is to the west. So, if we have over here on the west, we have the Holy of Holies, then the question is, does the menorah go north-south, its branches? And then what's called the Ner Ma'aravi, the western candle, was the central one, which would face towards the center. Or if the menorah was standing east-west, so then our Ner Ma'aravi was the second one from the end. So two opinions as to which way it was, east-west or north-south. There is a Yemenite tradition. We'll make our Yemenite happy here tonight. There is a Yemenite tradition that says, and if you're going to quote this, you have to quote where it's written. It is recorded in the Medrash Ma'or HaAfela, otherwise known in Arabic as Nur El Salam. And in that Medrash, he writes that when the Torah describes the menorah as having candlesticks equidistant from the Ner Ma'aravi, it means that the menorah was a circle. It was like a candelabra. You'll never hear, I've never heard anyone say that. The Yemenites have such interpretation. Right. Whatever. It's a long discussion. The Sephorno writes that the idea that all the seven lamps have to focus to one is the idea that in Judaism we will always have conflicting opinions. Those that pull to the right, those that pull to the left. But there's a central path towards Hashem. If we're focused there, then it's okay that we have differing opinions. If we're united in that sense. We move forward. Aaron waves each Levite. Special mitzvah of the Levites being dedicated. The Levites are going to shave all their hair. So can you imagine a Levite like Ron with a long white beard suddenly walking home one day and clean shaven? His wife might not have been so happy.
No eyebrows.
Clean shaven suddenly. So Aaron was clean shaven. The Levites were shaven now. And then they were anointed. What? I didn't see it addressed that he was an exception, so I assume so. I'm unaware one way or the other. I would assume so. It says Aaron was clean shaven and the Levites were clean shaven. Now, in this procession.
Moshe's not counted with the Levites.
Right. I don't know. I don't have a clear answer
on that. That makes sense why Korach's wife was making fun of Korach.
Could be. I don't know. I don't want to make assumptions. I'm sure it's addressed somewhere. I don't know. I don't know. The Levim are in service, right? Some Levites sing, some Levites carry, are in charge of the gates, and all of them carry the components of the Mishkan. The Levites spend 5 years learning, from 25 to 30, and then 20 years in service, from 30 to 50. From here we learn that if a person spent 5 years learning and they didn't see themselves getting any success, then they realize it's not for them. Most people, if they spend 5 years, they have a good Rebbe, and they're willing to focus, they're going to succeed. You're not going to master Shas in 5 years, but you're going to see that you're succeeding. You're going to retain.
Which age?
25 to 30. That's another problem. People start too young. That's one of the reasons children get frustrated with learning, because they're exposed to deep things on too young an age. The Levites started their actual work at 30. From 25 to 30 they were training. And now we have the mitzvah of Pesach. So before the mitzvah of Pesach, Moshe teaches them the laws of Pesach. He taught them once already. Right. Before each holiday, you have to review the laws of the holiday. And this is an important rule for you guys. There's a book called The Book of Our Heritage. I recommend you each get a copy. I recommend you start learning it. It's a book which you can review all year long. We're now in the end of the month of Sivan. What's relevant in the month of Sivan? Open the Book of Our Heritage. You're going to enter the month of Tammuz. What are the mitzvot of the month of Tammuz? What are the laws in the month of Tammuz? You open the Book of Our Heritage, you will learn not only the laws, but also the customs and the minagim and the midrashim. Also the different stories of each month. It's a phenomenal book, the Book of Our Heritage. You should own a copy. It's a great way to go around the year. Moshe Rabbeinu sees that Pesach's coming. He reviews with the Jewish people the laws of Pesach. Some people show up and say, we're defiled. We can't do the Pesach. Why should we be left out? There's a rule in life. In spiritual things, a person should always say, I don't want to be left out. When it comes to spirituality, you should stand up for your rights. Don't be left out. On physical things, a person should be willing to forgo things. On spiritual things, try to get what you can. Still be a kind person. Still try to get what you can. So Hashem gives us the mitzvah of Pesach Sheni. The idea that a month after Pesach, there's another Pesach, they could bring a second Paschal offering. Yes, sir.
So, okay, physical, whatever. But where does rude, insulting behavior, go the line from being like just an insult into something spiritual?
We're not never allowed to hurt other people. I shouldn't say never. We're not allowed to hurt other people.
So like if you're embarrassing somebody in public and you know, hurt his feelings and you make him feel uncomfortable, that's like, then it's like spiritual, then it just...
It says even a student before his Rebbe, if he knows that when he asks a certain question he's going to stump him, so don't ask the question.
Is that quoted in Halacha?
I think so. It's a Gemara in Chulin, and I think it's quoted in Halacha too, sure. After class, we could look it up. You could look it up. The Gemara darshans it from the Pasuk, V'samta sakin b'lo'echa, im ba'al nefesh ata, and I'm pretty sure it's quoted also in Hilchos Talmud Torah. Pretty sure. Okay, so you weren't confident, I wouldn't know. That was a joke.
One of those questions where it could be a little counterintuitive.
That's okay. No, your guys' job is to ask. Your job is to ask. Moshe is told to make two trumpets of silver. In this way, he's like a king. We have not yet transgressed with the spies. That's going to be in next week's parasha. So at this point, we're headed for Israel. And Hashem tells him when you blow the two trumpets, everyone shows up. When you blow one trumpet, only the leaders show up. When you blow a tkiah, true tkiah, it's a sign you're moving. Okay, this is a sign of Moshe's leadership. He has trumpets. He has a way of guiding the people. We have a mitzvah at a time of war to blow trumpets. So what's the idea of blowing trumpets? Rav Soloveitchik said that blowing shofar is like crying. When you cry, that's the greatest expression of connection. So it seems that chatzotzos are the same thing. The Torah says on Rosh Chodesh and on Yom Tiv, you blow the trumpets, and I will think about you. You'll be remembered before me. Corresponding to that, we have the Yalev Yavo. Yalev Yavo corresponds to the trumpets. What are we saying? Yalev Yavo V'yagev Yarev Yaretze. It should go up, and it should come, and it should make it there. And it should be seen, and it should be find favor, and it should be noticed. Our memory before you, right? All of this is an introduction to Zichroneinu, our memory. That's the same as the trumpets. Hashem says, I remember you. You blow the trumpets, I remember you. What were you asking? I'm sorry. Oh, so okay. If you take me down that road, story time. You have any sisters? Two sisters. Okay. So imagine We have Jared and his sister Susie. Jared comes down and he says, "Dad, can I take the car tonight?" And his father goes, "You didn't do your homework. You didn't do your chores. You're not getting such good grades in school. Your friends are a bunch of bums. They're just going out to hang out on town." No. Jared goes, "Dad, all the guys are going out. It's a special night. I hear that everyone's going to get together. Let me take the car." "Jared, I told you no. Leave me alone." "But Dad, come on." "Jared, go do your homework. Bye." Susie hears the whole conversation. He goes up the steps and he goes, "We ain't taking the car. Everyone's going out and we're not going to be there." Susie goes, "Okay." Jared says, "What do you mean, okay? We're not getting the car." Susie goes, "You're not getting the car." She goes down. Her father's working. She sits down next to him. And she starts sniffling. And a tear starts rolling down her cheek. The father looks up. "Susie, what's wrong?" "Nothing, Dad. I don't want to bother you. Keep working. It's okay." "Susie." You know the story. "Susie, but darling, what happened?" "Dad, it's... No, I don't want to bother you, Dad. Leave it. It's going to be all right." "But Susie, wait a second. What's bothering you?" She sits there crying, and her father stops what he's doing, and he sits down next to her. And then she says to him, "Dad, you know, I've been working hard, and I was hoping tonight I'd be able to go out and be with some of my friends. And I understand you want us to do all kinds of jobs around the house, and it's important. But it's an opportunity. I don't get that many opportunities to be with my friends." "Susie, you didn't ask. There's no problem. Take the car. You'll be back in 2-3 hours. There's enough time. You can still get your stuff done. Go, have a good time." Now, this is real. It could be Susie's tears weren't real, but there's a real emotion that awakens within a person when they see someone crying. Doesn't matter if it's a man or a woman. A tear is an expression of an emotion, and it speaks much better than our words can talk. The Rav Soloveitchik said, when the Torah tells us that the word Tru'ah is translated as Yevava, a cry, a wail, that means that when we blow shofar on Rosh Hashanah, what we're doing is we're expressing our cry before Hashem. "I don't know how to say what I need, God. I don't know how to express myself. I'm not going to say it right. But if I cry, you know I hurt. You know what I want. You'll figure out what I want." It would seem that the Chatzotzra is the same idea. Because Hashem says, "I remember you, I'll save you from your enemies, I'll remember you on your holidays." The Chatzotzra goes both ways. You blow it on your happiest day, you blow it on your dangerous day. So, Am Yisrael's traveling. We finally travel. 2 years since we've left Egypt. It's the second month. It's Iyar. And we're traveling. We're headed into Israel. It's an exciting time. And Moshe says to Yisrael, he says, "We're traveling to the place God promised us. Come with us. Things are going to be good for the Jewish people." Those of you who are interested, email me. I finally found an article I wrote about a decade ago about where the converts were supposed to have a section in the land of Israel. Some of you asked me this question. I told you I once researched it and wrote an article, and then I found it. Beit El asked me the question, Yeshivat Beit El, and I gave them the sources, and they put it on their website. But it might be in Hebrew. I don't even know if it's in English. So I found it. I came across it a week ago. Those of you who are interested, email me. It is discussed. So Moshe tells his father-in-law, "You've converted, you've joined the Jewish people, come with us." And he says, "No, I got to go back home and teach my family." And it doesn't tell us what happened. It doesn't tell us whether he came or not. It tells us the argument and it doesn't tell us the conclusion. Our tradition is that Yitro came back with his family. He went, converted his family, and they joined the Jewish people. They ended up living in Jericho, and then they emigrated out into the Judean desert, and they studied under Ya'avitz under Otniel ben Kenaz, and they became part of the leadership of the Jewish people. The descendants of Yitro became rabbis on the high court of the Jewish people, and they were a vibrant part of the Jewish people all the way till the destruction of the first temple. They were with us. And in Baalotcha we have the upside down Nuns. We have the story of the Aaron, Vayhi b'Nisua HaAaron. And our tradition is that this counts like a whole Sefer Torah, like a whole Chumash of the seven books of the Torah on its own. There's the Book of Bamidbar before this two verses, there's the Book of Bamidbar after. These two verses count as their own book. So there must be a very important message in these two verses, the idea of traveling, the Torah traveling, and Hashem clearing the way for the Torah, food for thought. The nation starts complaining. We've been traveling too fast, and the nation complains, and a fire breaks out, and then the nation comes and begs Moshe to pray on their behalf, and the fire sinks in the ground. And then people start complaining again, and they say, we remember the fish that was free in Egypt. What fish was free in Egypt? So, simple interpretation is like Bini saying, the Talmud in Tractate Sota tells us, the Gemara in Masechet Sotah tells us that when they draw water, they used to draw from areas in the Nile, that little fish would come out in the water, they'd boil the water, and they'd have fish soup, yeah. Free and easy and healthy and great. You know, today they discovered that our diet is low on omega-3 because we drink milk that the cattle doesn't eat grass. The cattle eats grains. They keep the cattle in the corral. They feed them grains. And so the milk that we drink doesn't have omega-3. And that affects us. They know. They don't know why. But they know that up until about 150 years ago, women used to have a regulated cycle. Every 29 and a half days, a woman got her period just like the moon, adjacent to the cycle of the moon. And then things started going quacky. Today, a woman can have her cycle every 21 month and 25 and 32, and it could be all over the place. They're not organized. But when a woman starts taking omega-3, then suddenly things start going back into the regular rhythm of things, and very often, they can suddenly resolve their fertility issues just because they're taking omega-3, and they don't know why. Meaning this is something that they see the phenomenon, and they're not sure why it works. So now, they're trying to get people to ingest more omega-3. So, because the cows, if they'd grow on grass, they'd have more omega-3. But they don't. The cows are eating grains. So they don't develop as much omega-3 in their food. So, in ancient times, if you were drinking, your water was cooked with fish, you were ingesting a lot of omega-3. The Talmud says when you eat small fish, when they would eat this would make them procreate a lot. Maybe this was part of the idea. Today we know omega-3 is very positive for procreation. It says this is what helped them have so many kids because they were eating all these small fish. That's what the Talmud says. So the nation says, we remember the fish that was available in Egypt for free. That's one interpretation. Our sages say that the word daga also means procreation, promiscuity. And what the nation was complaining about was, we remember back in Egypt where you could just pick up a girl off the street and things were free. We didn't have all these mitzvot about getting married and you can't marry your aunt and all these limitations. Life used to be free. The Talmud says, on the one hand, the Jewish people were faithful to their spouses. They maintained a family structure. And Hashem says, that's why I love them. On the other hand, they had more to choose from. Things were easier. Today, you can't marry your aunt. You're limited. There are a lot of women who you would be able to marry in the past where you couldn't marry them now. So the nation was complaining about it. We have the laws of family purity. The nation was complaining about it. And our sages say that there are two attitudes the Jewish people have had to mitzvot. There were mitzvot that the Jewish people adopted and they were happy about them. And they embraced them with both arms, and even when the nations tried to make decrees against them, they stood up to the nations. An example of that is Brit Milah. or even though there were decrees against us, Jews always loved the mitzvah of Brit Milah. As far-fetched as that sounds, Jews gave up their lives always, they should have a Brit Milah. And so till today, we hold on to that mitzvah and we love it. Jews always celebrate the mitzvah of Brit Milah. The Talmud says when it comes to the mitzvot of marriage, Jews always complained about that. Jews weren't, they didn't adopt these mitzvot happily. They said, oh Hashem, you're limiting us. And this is the first place we see it. The Jews were complaining about it. I would suggest, the Talmud doesn't say it, but I would suggest we see even in Egypt that Amram, the leader, separates from his wife. The people were prepared to compromise on marriages. So we won't be married. Amram separates from his wife. So the Talmud says, till today, you cannot have a marriage where there won't be some fighting. The Talmud says there's no such thing as a wedding without fighting, because the Jewish people did never embrace the mitzvos of the wedding with happiness. They never gave up their lives for it with happiness like they did over Brit Milah. So here we see another concept, that sometimes when we're doing something, we're not only affecting ourselves, we're affecting the national DNA. We're affecting the way the Jewish people as a whole will connect to a mitzvah. Yes, sir.
I have a question about the Brit Milah. When the children of Israel were in the wilderness for 40 years,
yes,
they did not take in Brit Milah. Yes. So when they finally got into the promised land, did they go straight back to Brit Milah, or was it like a process for them? Because it's 40 years and they could have forgotten about it, or they could have been hesitant to go back to it.
The pasuk in the beginning of the book of Yeshua records that when we entered the land of Israel right away, there was a mass circumcision. It says there was a hilltop of foreskins called Givat Haralot, the hilltop of foreskins. That's a pasuk. And it was exceptionally dangerous for them to do it, because here they had just entered the land of Israel. They couldn't know when they'd be attacked. Right? Think about it. This is how two brothers were able to take down a whole city of Shechem, because they had all circumcised. And here the Jewish people are entering the land of Israel, and right away mass circumcision. So that's, tactically, that's not what we would tell an army to do. We'd say, do third of your army now, another third in 4 months after the first third healed, right? Pasuk says not that way. They all did it right away. It's mind-boggling. It says they camped there and they stayed there until they all healed. It says they all did it.
So just before they entered the
church. When, after they entered. After they entered, and once they were circumcised, they could bring the Korban Pesach. And they did bring the Korban Pesach a few days after they entered Israel. But first they had a mass circumcision.
Doesn't Rav Harlav talk about this when Yaakov's fighting Esau's angel? That he specifically hits him in the nerve, in the sciatic nerve, because that it's not natural for the Jew?
I don't remember.
That's why you don't eat meat.
I don't remember.